County Public Broadcasting. This is the KZYX News for Monday, April 22nd. I'm Sarah Reif. Saturday's Earth Day celebration at Todd Grove Park in Ukiah was a smorgasbord of environmentally themed activities. Students from the City of 10,000 Buddhas shared music and a performance about compassion for the earth. Experts stood at booths engaging passersby on compost and electric cars. A dog waste removal service called the Poop Ferry competed with the Army Corps of Engineers for attention. Michelle Goodman, the Education and Outreach Manager for CNS Waste Solutions, was on hand to remind visitors of some recycling tips.
We still encourage people to not be putting plastic bags in their recycling, in their blue recycling cart. We're working on, hopefully, in the next few months, rolling out being able to put paper cups in the blue bin. We're working with a company on doing a big public education campaign on that, because the mills are starting to want to accept the paper cups that you get when you get your coffee, things like that. So hoping to roll that out here soon.
CNS finished building a new compost facility about 2 years ago, and last year it generated about 5,000 tons of compost. Goodman said the compost, which is for sale at the transfer center in Ukiah and shows up occasionally for free at various locations determined by the city or county, is certified organic and regularly tested for a variety of undesirable elements.
We can provide the testing results to you so that you could see if there like are fecal coliform, if we're passing, different types of things that people are looking for in their soil, so that you know that we're not giving you bad stuff.
SB 1383 is a state law that required jurisdictions to cut short-lived climate pollutants like methane starting in 2022. That involved new mandates on composting green waste as well as food scraps and cutting down on food waste in the first place by keeping edible items out of the landfill. CalRecycle, which is implementing the sprawling legislation, has set a goal of diverting 75% of organic waste below 2014 levels by next year. Goodman says Mendocino County isn't there yet, but is not alone.
I can tell you what our diversion rate here is locally. So for Franchise Area 2, which is like the biggest part of the county, we're at about a 40% diversion rate, which is pretty good. The state target is 75%, so we still have quite a ways to go, but we're doing a lot better than a lot of other areas in California. In terms of where California is, they definitely have not reached the statewide goal of 75%. But, you know, SB 1383 is still, like, fully ramping up. There's still some jurisdictions that are exempted from SB 1383. So I think it's going okay, but definitely haven't hit that target.
On the other end of the park, under the oak trees by the swimming pool, Cecilia Sullivan, President Emeritus of the North Bay Electric Auto Association, presided over the electric car show. About 24 EV owners had opened their hoods, trunks, and frunks for visitors to peruse.
We have a lot of different battery electric vehicles. We have a few plug-in hybrid electric vehicles. Those ones we use gasoline as well, but you can plug them in and use electric range. This little small little vehicle we have is the Arcimoto FUV. That's for a fun utility vehicle. It's a nice little car for, you know, getting around. This has a Cybertruck. It's a big vehicle. It's the most popular vehicle here. A lot of people are coming around and checking it out, so that's been kind of cool. We have some older vehicles like the Leaf, which have been around since like 2013 or so.
And they have a lot of storage space where the engine of a lot of gas-powered vehicles is.
Right. So a lot of EVs, since they don't have to have the engine there, they will put the motors in between the wheels, and then that allows space up in the front for a front trunk, or a frunk, as many people like to call them.
One of the big concerns that people have, especially here in Mendocino County where we have power outages, is the ability of the grid to sustain this much of a fleet if everybody were to get an electric vehicle. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, my thoughts are that if we were to actually make everything electric, we would actually use less energy than we are using for like refining gasoline, moving around fuel products. And as we add more solar, more grid storage, it'll be a much more sustainable and well-supported system.
Sullivan noted that the cost of EVs is coming down and that more powerful work vehicles are coming onto the market. Tom Liberatore was not trying to get any work done with his Arcimoto FUV, or fun utility vehicle, a three-wheeled rig that one passenger told him rides like an aircraft.
It goes 85 miles an hour. It has a roughly 100-mile range, unless you drive it the way I drive it. And then it goes maybe 50 to 70 miles. But it's an amazing amount of fun, and as you can see, the reaction it gets from people, they can see the possibilities, you know, of a different way to get around. It's way better than a car.
Describe it for listeners who can't see it.
Well, my wife thinks it looks like a helicopter. It's black and yellow. It's very striking. It has red wheels. It's three wheels. And it kind of has the profile of a helicopter or a small aircraft.
You see a helicopter, I see a motorcycle, and it's kind of a car.
In addition to the fun ride, there were games where kids could test their knowledge about plastic pollution and how long it takes various items to break down. There was a comic about wolves. Earth Day is also about political awareness.
I'm Ada B. Fine, and I represent ducks and quack, 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 quack. And we have a political platform. We would like the swamp to come back to Washington, D.C., because it was a swamp before all the people and buildings took over it, and the ducks and frogs and herons and all those good critters really liked it like that. And, the ducks are a slow, waddling movement. We might take over the world, so be prepared for lots of quacking. Quack.
For KZYX News, I'm Sarah Reif. For all our local news, with photos and more, visit kzyx.org. You can also subscribe to the KZYX News podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for the world comes from Odoo. Odoo is a fully integrated suite of business applications designed to simplify and streamline every aspect of your company. More information at odoo.com/the world. That's odoo.com/the world.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for being here today. Israel's head of military intelligence is stepping down. Major General Aharon Haliva says he's taking responsibility for the intelligence failure that led up to the Hamas attack of October 7th. The details of that day have been extensively reported. 1,200 people were killed and hundreds more were taken hostage. But Israelis are still waiting for accountability from a government they say did not keep them safe from the worst attack on Israelis in the country's modern history.
Yossi Melman is a longtime Israeli intelligence reporter and author. He writes for the newspaper Haaretz. We reached him in Tel Aviv as Passover was beginning there for reaction to Haliva's resignation.
Well, Israelis have been expecting it because he and other generals and even cabinet minister, the Minister of Defense, Yoav Gallant, said more or less immediately after the war in the first week or the first 2 weeks that they are responsible, but they didn't specify when and how they would materialize this responsibility. If I assume that more will leave their post sooner or later.
Tell us a little bit more about Haliva and the reasons he gave for stepping down.
Well, the reason was the colossal failure. He is not alone. It's a shared responsibility. That was a colossal failure, unprecedented. I think it was the worst disaster to the Israeli society, to the Israeli military, to the state of Israel since its creation in 1948. There are so many culprits in the events which led to the Hamas attack on October 7th. The intelligence failure was the lack of understanding Hamas, the lack of information about their intentions. Still, the upper echelon of the military, including Haliva, showed a great deal of arrogance. They did not listen to the sounds, to the voices, to the noises that were coming out of Gaza, which should have been interpreted as a preparation for a major attack on Israel.
Yeah, I mean, there were spotters with Israel Defense Forces on the border of Gaza who complained that their assessments pointing towards an impending attack were ignored. Some key officers were women. What's going on there? Is this a societal bias in intelligence or bad leadership? What do you think?
Well, it's both. It's both. It's everything. There were these young female soldiers in the war rooms observing the fans with the sensors and with cameras, and they looked at what they saw on the other side, and they said Hamas is preparing for something big. But their bosses, mainly male, so it's also a kind of a male chauvinist culture in the military, that said, you just tell us what you see, don't try to analyze. We are the ones to analyze what is happening. We know better. We understand better. So that was one aspect of the failure. Then there were other elements, for example, the thin presence of troops along the border. Everyone is now, in retrospect, is saying, hadn't been, if the IDF would have beefed up its troops and would send more soldiers, then probably Hamas would not be able to infiltrate Israel, certainly not on the same scale and range. Intelligence was there. Indications were there. The analysis was bad, and the leadership, and it's not just the military leadership, it's also the political leadership, all of them ignored it because they were prisoners of what we call the concept. And the concept was that Hamas is weak. Hamas is not interested in war. Hamas is interested more in rehabilitating and reconstructing Gaza. And they've been doing it by channeling money from Qatar to Gaza. Most of the money actually did not reach the people. It reached Hamas to build its underground tunnels and to build its huge arsenal of missiles. And above all, the Israeli government, led by Prime Minister Netanyahu, encouraged Qatar to send the money there.
So, Yossi, what do you think this high-level resignation of the intel chief means for Prime Minister Netanyahu, who up until this point has been fairly unwilling to acknowledge a role in the intelligence failure?
Well, his resignation will trigger a chain reaction. I have no doubt that the head of the Shin Bet, Ronen Bar, will resign. Actually, he said that he would resign. He's just waiting for the inquiries, internal inquiries of the Shin Bet failure. The chief of staff, Lieutenant General Herzl Levy, will, no doubt about it, will resign. The big question is whether the Minister of Defense, Yoav Gallant, who is a politician, will resign. And above all, towering above all these events is Netanyahu, who is the prime minister and is the main culprit and responsible for devising this policy. It doesn't look that he would accept responsibility. He has refused to accept responsibility so far, and he would not resign.
Going back to the statement from the now-resigned intelligence chief, Aaron Haliva, it was filled with contrition. I have carried that black day, referring to October 7th, with me ever since, day after day, night after night. I will carry the horrible pain of the war with me forever. Yossi, if that is how he feels, why did he not resign on October 8th? Are Israelis asking that today?
Oh, yes. Yes. I mean, the Israelis are saying it's better late than never.
Yeah, I'm curious to know, Yossi Melman, you've covered the Israeli intelligence community for decades. How does this moment feel to you?
Well, I would say that, first of all, all the senior chiefs of the Israeli intelligence are ashamed, confused, cannot provide explanations. They don't understand what happened and why it happened to them. And this is also my assumption, my feeling, my understanding, my conclusion of what happened, that it's human futility. People arrogant, people believe that they know better. And because of that, will it be the last Israeli intelligence failure? I don't think so.
Yossi Melman is a longtime intelligence reporter for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz.
After months of political gridlock, Congress has voted to send more funding to Ukraine.
On this vote, the yeas are 311 and the nays are 112. The bill is passed.
Over the weekend, the House passed a $95 billion foreign aid package for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. Nearly two-thirds of that money is for Ukraine. The World's Daniel Offman is based in Riga, Latvia, and has been following the story closely. Daniel, $61 billion from that funding is going to Ukraine. What is that money going to be used for?
Yeah, Carolyn. So in a nutshell, there are three categories of spending here. The first is about $14 billion in security assistance for Ukraine. So that money is used to purchase weapons. And the way it works is that the Pentagon buys weapons from U.S. contractors and then sends them to Ukraine. So that's the first category. The second one, which is about $34 billion, are funds that bolster U.S. security needs. So a big part of that is replenishing U.S. weapons stockpiles. And it also includes funding that's meant to strengthen U.S. military capabilities in Europe closer to Ukraine.
So replenishing U.S. stockpiles, is that to replace things that we have sent over to Ukraine?
Yeah, that's right. And it would also allow the U.S. in the future to send more weapons to Ukraine.
Okay. And then the third pot of money?
The third category is about $9 billion, which is non-military funding. And that aid, paid and forgivable loans, is meant to fill the gaps in Ukraine's national budget. It'll pay for things like damaged power plants, damaged housing and other infrastructure. So the bill includes funding for a wide range of things that Ukrainians desperately need right now.
The U.S. has been sending money to Ukraine since basically the beginning of this war. How does this package compare to money that the U.S. and other countries have already provided?
So this package is significant. And to put it in perspective, over the last 2 years, the U.S. has already provided about $74 billion in aid to Ukraine. That's more than any other country. And that money pays for weapons, military training, humanitarian aid, and financial aid for Ukraine's government. Now, European countries and institutions have provided even more than the U.S., but the U.S. provides the lion's share in military aid. And that's especially crucial right now because Ukraine's government has been saying that they've been running low on air defense capabilities and ammunition. So this aid, which includes that military assistance, is a significant boost to Ukraine right now.
Yeah, as you mentioned, Kyiv has been asking for this funding for a long time. How is Ukraine reacting now that it's actually coming through?
Yeah, so people in Ukraine are fairly happy, and there was a lot of gratitude and relief. Here's Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky speaking yesterday. He said, "I thank everyone who supported this package. This is a life-saving decision." On social media, many Ukrainians were also thanking the U.S., and they reposted images of Democratic members of Congress waving Ukrainian flags on the House floor. So this was a moment of joy for many Ukrainians and a significant political and diplomatic victory. But on the other hand, leading up to this moment, there was a lot of frustration among Ukrainians because the bill took so long to pass, and the delay had a negative impact on the ground in Ukraine.
So let's talk about the other side of this conflict. Has there been a response from Moscow regarding this funding?
Yeah. In Russia, Putin's press secretary, Dmitry Peskov, said that the result of this bill will be, quote, the death of more Ukrainians. Russian foreign ministry spokesperson Maria Zakharova said military assistance for the Kyiv regime is direct sponsorship of terrorist activity. Hmm. And the aid package also made headlines in pro-government newspapers and on Russian state TV. This is Margarita Simonyan, the editor-in-chief of Russia Today. She said, "Only we can finish this war, and this will happen only when we reach our goals." Ultimately, she said, it will end with Russia's victory, even if the U.S. keeps supporting Ukraine financially and militarily. So a message of defiance from top Russian officials and propagandists.
Right. Defiant, as you said. Just how quickly will this aid start flowing to Ukraine, Daniel?
So first, the package needs to pass in the Senate, and a vote is expected to happen tomorrow, and then it'll be signed into law by President Biden. Once that happens, the Pentagon says it'll move fairly quickly. Here's Major General Patrick Ryder, the Pentagon press secretary, speaking to reporters last week.
We have a very robust logistics network that enables us to move materiel very quickly. As we've done in the past, we can move within days.
The U.S. already has stockpiles of weapons ready in Europe. So according to the Pentagon, as soon as they get the green light, weapons will begin moving into Ukraine almost immediately.
The World's Daniel Offman reporting in Riga, Latvia.
and South Poles are warming faster than anywhere else on Earth. And now we know that there's one continent heating up faster than all the others. That's just ahead. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The planet is getting warmer, and temperatures in Europe are rising faster than on any other continent. Two climate monitoring groups are reporting today that Europe is warming up about twice as fast as the global average. Julian Nicholas is a senior scientist with the Copernicus Climate Research Center. He's based in Reading in the UK.
This faster warming rate, it's because compared to other continents, so the proportion of the European continent that is close or within the northern polar regions is larger. So there's more land that is close to the Arctic compared to other continents.
So why is Europe warming up so much more quickly than other places?
There are essentially three main reasons. One is the fact that a greater part of Europe compared to other continents is closer to the pole, which is the fastest warming region on Earth. The second factor is a change in the weather patterns that tend to make heat waves more frequent in Europe during the summer. And finally, due to improvement in air quality and reduced pollution, there is also more solar radiation hitting Europe, which is contributing to the warming of the air.
Right. So counterintuitively, when there's less air pollution, actually more of the sun's heat reaches Earth because we've cleaned up the atmosphere, right?
Exactly. There's very clear benefits for human health or for the environment. But one downside is that it can contribute to warmer air over the long term.
So let's put some numbers on this. The average global temperature increase across the world was about 1.3 degrees Celsius last year, which is about 2.3 degrees Fahrenheit. What are we talking for Europe?
So we're talking about the temperature change since what we call the pre-industrial period, so the second half of the 19th century. So for Europe, it was about 2.3. So a little bit less than twice that.
2.3 degrees Celsius, which is about 4.1 Fahrenheit.
Yes, about that.
So your report focused on the impact of warming on human health. I understand that heat is one of the most deadly impacts of climate change to health. Is that correct?
There are some clear health risks related to extreme heat and heat waves. And we see an increase in heat-related death in the past 20 years due to more frequent heat waves happening in Europe. So again, in 2023, a number of heat waves hit the continent during the summer.
So how well equipped are European countries to handle these rising temperatures?
This adaptations to this more frequent heat wave and extreme heat, I think, is not where it should be. And this is one of the highlight or one of the findings of the report is that I think there's a recommendations for European countries to better account for the health risk related to extreme heat in their adaptation plan to climate change.
It strikes me for years, the amount of temperature rise we've been talking about is a figure that seems hard to feel when you walk outside the door. But now we're getting to a place where you can feel that difference. It's 4.1 degrees Fahrenheit hotter. You kind of know the difference between 70 degrees and 74 degrees.
And we are seeing the effect of this warming in the environment where we live, whether it's flowers and trees blooming early in the summer, the glaciers melting, or more extreme heat earlier in the year, heat waves or extreme rainfalls or drought. So I think, we are experiencing really climate change on an individual levels more than we used to.
Julian Nicholas is a senior scientist with the Copernicus Climate Research Center.
Chinatown in Washington, D.C. was once a home to a thriving Chinese immigrant community. The neighborhood still exists, but you might say in name only. Chain coffee shops and a sports arena have pushed out many businesses and residents. So if you want to find Asian groceries these days, your best bet is traveling to the Virginia suburbs. For WAMU, reporter Amanda Michelle Gomez caught a ride with some shoppers from D.C.'s Chinatown.
Hello, Two dozen Wallach House residents are on their way to the Great Wall Supermarket in Falls Church, Virginia. It's a 30-minute drive from their apartment in D.C.'s Chinatown, so they pass the time with a song. Wallach Adult Daycare Center charters a bus for the group of seniors to go grocery shopping once a month. It cares for roughly 90 senior citizens, all of whom are Asian immigrants. But their neighborhood has no Chinese grocery stores.
A lot of like veggie, you know, Chinese, a lot of things they don't have. They're like giant or Safeway. They only American food.
That's Si Ming Chan. Originally from Hong Kong, he's lived in Wallach House for more than a decade. He's also president of the Tenant Association. Chan explains why a Chinese grocery store in his neighborhood is needed.
Why? Because a lot of Chinese, they need a Chinese food.
At Great Wall Supermarket, the food isn't just familiar. It's affordable. Seniors get daikon radishes for 58 cents a pound. At the store near their home, Safeway, these radishes go for $2.49 each. Great Wall also translates produce signs into Chinese, but daycare center staff are still around to help.
Excuse me, sir. He wants the bottom.
Staff member Jessica Yang is helping Wallach resident Su Kwan Fu order meat. She also translates for him.
Okay, so he comes here a few times a month. So one time with us, and other times he will go with his friends. His friends will drive him here to buy the groceries.
She says Fu wishes his neighborhood had a store like this so he can shop multiple times a week. In March, multiple Wallach seniors made their case for a Chinese grocery store at a D.C. zoning hearing.
The next case is application number 20974 of RVP 8th Street Northwest LLC.
The virtual hearing was technically about a proposed hotel around the corner from Wallach House. Senior said they didn't support the proposal because it would close Gaoya Salon and Full Key Restaurant, two of the few remaining Chinese businesses in Chinatown. They'd rather the hotel be a grocery store. The Save Chinatown Solidarity Network also protested the development. Here's organizer Ren Li.
Where can the last remaining Chinese residents go to get their food, meet their friends, get their haircuts, and exist in this vanishing community?
But Zoning Adjustment Board Chair Fred Hill said his body couldn't help Wallach residents.
So we're not the city council, and we don't provide oversight for anything other than very narrow zoning regulations.
The director of the Wallach Adult Daycare Center, Rita Lee, thinks there's something the D.C. government can do. She says lawmakers should incentivize a business or landlord to open up a grocery store. Lee is a part of Mayor Muriel Bowser's Chinatown Task Force, and she says numerous people in meetings have advocated for a store.
Yeah, I think it's very difficult to get this dream come true, but I never say never.
In the meantime, her daycare will continue to bus Wallach residents to the suburbs to shop for their food. For The World, Amanda Michelle Gomez, Washington, D.C.
You're listening to The World.
Support for KZYX comes from our members in Project Sanctuary. For 47 years, Project Sanctuary has been helping victims of domestic violence and sexual assault, providing emergency shelter, transitional housing, counseling, education, and more. For help 24/7, 707-463-4357 inland and 707-964-4357 on the coast. Se habla español.
The World is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Progressive Insurance, with the Name Your Price tool, offering a range of coverage and price options to choose from. Now that's Progressive. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And from StoryWorth. Each week, StoryWorth emails a loved one a question about their life. After a year, they'll publish family memories into a bound book to keep forever. Learn more at storyworth.com.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Tensions in Germany around support for Israel are coming to a head in Berlin. German police banned a pro-Palestinian event there, organized by Arab, Jewish, and German organizations. Authorities have also cracked down on a Jewish group opposed to Israel's actions in Gaza. Some critics see moves like these as threats to freedom of speech, with troubling echoes from Germany's past. From Berlin, Rebecca Collard reports.
Dr. Rosan Abusita is a British-Palestinian surgeon and rector of the University of Glasgow. He spent the early days of the war in Gaza treating Palestinians, and he rose to prominence, speaking almost daily to international media about the dire situation of Gaza's collapsing medical system.
Basically, when I handed in my passport at the passport desk, I was told that I needed to step aside. And then three policemen came and escorted me to a room in the basement of the airport, where I stayed for 3.5 hours.
Abusita was coming to attend the Palestina Congress, a three-day conference in the German capital that included Arab, Jewish, German, and other European speakers.
I was asked what I was doing in Germany. I told them that I'm here attending a congress, that as a witness to the crimes happening in Gaza, I've been asked by the congress organizers to give my evidence to what I had seen at Shifa and at Al Ahli hospitals.
A German government spokesperson told The World that they could not comment on why Abusita was not allowed to enter Germany, citing data protection reasons. But conference organizers and activists say it's a sign of growing repression here of any criticism of Israel, the war in Gaza, or German policy. As Abusita was being held in the Berlin airport, the congress he was meant to address was being shut down by German police. Organizers say when they arrived at the venue Friday morning, they were met with hundreds of police officers. The congress sold around 800 tickets, but police told them just 250 people were allowed in. Videos from inside show dozens of officers. Eventually, police shut off the power, take the participants' microphones, and declare the Congress canceled. Police said the conference was shut down not because of anything that was said, but because of the risk that a speaker could use anti-Semitic speech or glorify violence, which could violate German law. In a press conference a few days later, Sonja Koch, a spokesperson for the Ministry of Interior, told journalists that the Palestina Congress had been banned because of Islamist propaganda and hatred towards Jews. But Matt De Vlieger disagrees. He's a member of Jüdische Stimme, or Jewish Voice, a leftist Jewish organization which was involved in organizing the Palestina Congress.
This is supposed to be a public education event, and the Jüdische Stimme was taking funds for tickets and ticket sales and using those for the Congress, and now our bank account has been seized, which seems to be a politically motivated action.
The bank, Berliner Sparkasse, demanded a list of all of Jewish Voices members and their addresses, a move the organization was quick to compare to Nazi-era policies. Sparkasse, which is owned by the state of Berlin, told The World it doesn't comment on existing client relationships, but that accounts are never arbitrarily blocked, and said the check was routine. But De Vlieger doesn't buy that. He himself was detained by police at the Congress after they demanded he unroll a banner he was holding closed that read, "Jews Against Genocide" in German.
Germany and German power is going to call anything they don't like anti-Semitic. They've been calling Jews anti-Semitic. Jews have been disproportionately canceled in this country over the last months, and they've used the term anti-Semitism against everything that they don't like. You can't just say if you don't like something, it's anti-Semitic. I'm sorry.
Meanwhile, Dr. Rosan Abusita was sent back to the UK. He says at the end of his interrogation in Berlin, he was told not only was he banned from entering Germany until the end of April,
that they threatened that even if I tried to speak through Zoom in Germany during that period, or send a recorded video to Germany from somewhere else, that I would be breaching German law with the risk of a fine or for a year's imprisonment.
And he was not alone. Former Greek finance minister Yanis Varoufakis was also supposed to speak at the event. In a video statement, Varoufakis said he was told he was banned from making any political speeches in Germany, and like Abusita, was not even allowed to speak remotely from another country.
German police proved beyond reasonable doubt by bursting in and interrupting the live stream, grabbing the microphone, ending that magnificent Congress, that fascism does not need to win government in order to be in power.
And while German officials say they are acting on their historic responsibility to protect Israel and Jewish people, activists here say the lesson Germany should be taking from its history is the importance of allowing political dissent. For The World, I'm Rebecca Collard, Berlin.
Earlier this month, the World Health Organization recorded its first case of a human catching H5N1, a kind of bird flu, from another mammal. A variant of the virus found its way into dairy cows here in the U.S. back in March. And earlier this month, a case of cow-to-human transmission was reported in Texas. Since 2003, the WHO has documented almost 900 cases of humans getting H5N1. To learn more, I spoke with Massimo Palmarini. He's the director of the Center for Virus Research at the University of Glasgow in Scotland. I started by asking him how concerned we should be about H5N1 virus spreading from birds to mammals.
So until a few weeks ago, the situation was pretty much the same for humans. So most of the cases, almost all of them, were spillover events where there was an infection of an individual fox or a seal. There are some indication that in sea lions in South America, there might be animal-to-animal transmission. So now what is different with the dairy cows is that there is definitely animal-to-animal transmission. So it's not just a spillover event, but it's also transmission then from an infected cow to an uninfected cow. So these chain of transmission are more concerning because then the virus can start to sort of learn how to replicate in mammals. Mm. So that can lead to different scenarios.
Is it also easier for humans to contract this from mammals versus birds? So is that another reason why this might be more concerning?
Yes, so basically when I say it's very difficult for an avian virus to learn to replicate in a human and in human cells, we have different blocks, genetic blocks that the avian virus find difficult to overcome. Now, by going into a cow, for example, this avian virus then becomes a bit less avian and start to be able to adapt in a mammal. So then that's one consideration. The other considerations that, of course, as having domestic cows where there is a close proximity, of course, of humans and cows.
Right.
So the possibility of these viruses basically recombining, and where you have a virus that is a bit deriving from the human virus, a bit from another virus, and then when they recombine, they create, in essence, a new virus that might have some characteristic for both. Of course, the danger is that we have no antibodies against H5N1, as opposed to the viruses instead that are the seasonal influenza viruses circulating in the populations.
How lethal is H5N1 for both birds and mammals and humans?
So, for example, the cases so far that have been recorded in humans has been a mild infection. So that I think there are a bit less than 900 cases that have been recorded since 1997, and about half of them were associated with lethal infections. In domestic chickens can cause severe disease, and this strain can cause severe disease also in some of the wild birds.
Massimo, last year, your team actually identified the human gene that helps protect humans from bird flu.
Yeah.
You know, I'm thinking, of course, back to coming up with the vaccine for COVID-19, and I wonder, how well prepared are we right now if bird flu were to expand aggressively through the human population? Would we be able to quickly develop a vaccine?
I think that the situation would be considerably different because we already know the virus. We already have a decade of experience on the virus. There are antivirals available, and there are seed vaccines so that countries keep in case of a pandemic, for example, for H1N1. And what I understand from colleagues in the US, it seems that the ones that are in stock at the moment seem to neutralize this particular virus. So we would start with an advantage compared to with SARS-CoV-2.
So we already have vaccines laying in wait for this.
Yeah, that's right. Now, of course, then it's not an easy task then to scale up productions and all that. So it's not that there will not be considerable problems. But I think it is a controllable situation at the moment if taken seriously, as it should be.
You say controllable. What else can humans or should humans be doing to stop bird flu from spreading both in animal populations and in humans?
The key now is the outbreaks in the U.S. dairy farms. How are we going to control those, and what it is that can be done to stop the infection to going through other dairy farms? At the very moment, the exposure for humans is limited, so that the risk is minimum. But of course, if then you get the virus become endemic in the cattle populations in the US, and then it spreads all over, then it becomes more of an issue. So I think the point is to act now to avoid the virus really to take hold and become endemic in cows. I think what is the we can do is to control the infection now.
Massimo Palmarini is the director of the Center for Virus Research at the University of Glasgow in Scotland. He joined us to talk about H5N1 spreading from birds to mammals and most recently to humans.
Politics in Russia in the 1990s are the backdrop for a new play called Patriots. It's written by Peter Morgan, best known for his credits on The Crown, and like the Netflix series, his play is based on real-life characters. It's about a Russian oligarch who supports a then little-known deputy mayor named Vladimir Putin, and yeah, the oligarch gets more than he bargained for. The play opens tonight on Broadway. Here's reporter Jeff London in New York.
Patriots feels like a Shakespeare history play. There are dozens of characters, political treachery, and at the center, a large, flawed, and ultimately tragic character, Boris Berezovsky. The billionaire kingmaker is played by Michael Stuhlbarg.
It really feels like a modern Shakespeare play. There are remnants of Shylock, remnants of Richard III.
The king Berezovsky makes is a low-level political functionary and former KGB agent, Vladimir Putin. Berezovsky helps him rise to power, but discovers he can't control him.
You cannot separate business and politics when the state is bankrupt! You need our money! Without the oligarchs, you stand no chance!
I'm not sure that I see it that way. I see a country that has fallen into the hands of a few self-interested crooks.
Director Rupert Gould says playwright Peter Morgan's themes really are Shakespearean.
How power is enabled, how absolute power corrupts absolutely, how betrayal, in a way, maybe the central theme of the whole play is loyalty and betrayal and different ideas of that. Betrayal in some way being the opposite of patriotism.
Along the way, the audience is introduced to a variety of figures from Russia in the 1990s. Among them, oligarch Roman Abramovich and KGB agent turned dissident Alexander Litvinenko. They have differing ideas of what patriotism means, says Will Keane, who plays Putin.
What is patriotism beyond a profound love of the country, and it's possible to do all sorts of things in the name of love, both good and bad. So I think that every character in the play is profoundly sort of attached in a sort of essential way to the idea of Russia.
The actors research their characters beyond the script. Michael Stuhlbarg watched videos of Boris Berezovsky, a mathematician who got a master's degree in decision-making theory before he made the decision to become a businessman.
There was a wonderful frontline interview that was conducted about either a year or a few months before he died. He was very animated and very candid. I listened to his voice, I watched his mannerisms.
Here, Berezovsky is forcefully telling Roman Abramovich how he's got the ear of Boris Yeltsin.
Furthermore, I can confirm that said lame duck now wishes to retire to alternately look after the health of his heart and suckle on the tit of his vodka bottle, and he comes to me to discuss who should replace him. Huh? Me! Me!
Will Keane also studied videos of Vladimir Putin, not just as the man we now know, but as an awkward, insecure non-entity. Keane says in Peter Morgan's script, Putin's physical journey is part of the character's emotional journey.
There's this sequence that Peter's written into it of him rehearsing in a mirror sort of how to wear the face of a leader. And that sense of his performativeness actually is something else that I've observed and has interested me a lot. The sense of a kind of mask that he has put on. It's a role.
Right before Patriot started rehearsals for its first production in England 2 years ago, Putin's Russia invaded Ukraine. Director Rupert Gould says,
you know, what had been a historical play that then we've been centering on the character of Boris suddenly became a much more urgent contemporary political play.
And it seems even more urgent now between Alexei Navalny's death and Putin's re-election. It's hard to not think about recent events when, in the play, an exiled Berezovsky tells Alexander Litvinenko's widow how it's important to resist Putin.
And rid the country we all love of that monster Putin was my mistake. Getting rid of him is my responsibility.
Oh. Despite his efforts, Berezovsky never was able to do it, and he died under very suspicious circumstances. Rupert Gould says Berezovsky was
the facilitator for Putin, and Putin's rise is definitely on his hands, but he was also the canary down the mineshaft about seeing what was coming.
And in 2024, what's to come? Patriots opens this evening. For The World, I'm Jeff London, New York.
Earlier this hour, we reported on the new aid package for Ukraine. Part of the deal to pass that measure included legislation that would ban the social media app TikTok in the U.S. if the parent company ByteDance doesn't sell its stake in the app. Backers of the bill say ByteDance's Chinese ownership poses a security risk. Critics of the legislation say those fears are overblown. The Senate takes up the measure next.
Meanwhile, in Europe, a different app from the same company has regulators taking action. TikTok Lite is a new platform that pays users to watch videos, and that is raising eyebrows among European regulators who worry about young people getting addicted. This week, those regulators may just go and ban that app. Join us tomorrow on The World when we'll have the latest on what the EU is deciding. Listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Ecuador was long known as one of the safest countries in Latin America. For decades, it managed to escape the sort of drug and gang violence that engulfed its neighbors. Now that era looks like it's over. Drug gang violence is surging in many of Ecuador's cities and towns. In response, the country's new president, Daniel Noboa, asked the public for broad new powers to crack down on organized crime. And this weekend, Ecuadorian voters took part in a referendum that gives Noboa what he asked for. To find out what this could mean, we reached out to Sebastian Hurtado. He heads the political risk consultancy Profitas in Ecuador's capital, Quito. I asked him to explain the upshot of this weekend's referendum.
Basically, President Noboa gets a stronger political mandate to fight crime because it is pretty clear from the results that that's what the Ecuadorians wanted. Some of those have to do with an easier way for the military forces to be involved in fighting organized crime. Also, Ecuadorians approved constitutional reform allowing for authorities to extradite Ecuadorian criminals to other countries.
Right, so making things easier for the state to seize the property of a crime organization's extradition of criminals. So, Sebastian, if you had to give a headline to the referendum and these new powers President Noboa has been given, what would you say is the big news? What is the big change now in Ecuador?
After early gains in the fight against crime in the early months of this year, you know, we've seen a continuous rise of criminality in the last month. So we still have to see if the government, with the same military forces as before, with the same police forces, and with the same institutions that I think are ill-prepared to deal with the level of criminality that Ecuador is facing right now. Let's see if the president, with the same institutions, can deliver lasting results in the fight against crime. We still have to see that.
So a big concern widely when it comes to cracking down on crime is that the crackdown can become too draconian. We've seen in El Salvador, President Nayib Bukele has taken a hardline approach toward drug gangs. His government's also been accused of violating human rights, throwing thousands of innocent people into prison. How much of a worry is that for people in Ecuador?
There's been an increasing number of voices voicing concern about it. However, I think the situation in Ecuador is different. I think President Noboa has not been trying to take over state institutions, for example. So I don't think he has given himself the power that President Bukele has given himself in El Salvador. And the other difference is I think the war against criminal organizations in Ecuador is different from that in El Salvador. I mean, Ecuador is right now one of the largest exporters of cocaine to the world. And it's a criminal organization in Ecuador are deeply connected with major criminal cartels in Colombia and Mexico. So the Ecuadorian government is facing a much better prepared, organized, armed, and financed criminal organizations that are not only local, but connected internationally.
Talk more about that, Sebastian. How are these local gangs in Ecuador connected to larger groups like the cartels that we hear about operating in Colombia and Mexico that seem to have an almost corporate hold on smaller operations?
Basically, those large organizations that control the cocaine traffic from Colombia and Peru, and that are basically Colombian and Mexican cartels, found this new route to move their products through Ecuadorian ports. And for that, they required local support. And that's basically when they got connected with all these criminal gangs in Ecuador and have built this network to support their operation through Ecuador. Ecuador right now exports 60% of the cocaine that reaches Europe and Asia. Ecuador is a major piece of the global cocaine business right now. We are part of a much bigger, intricate business operation.
So President Noboa now has this mandate from the people who voted in this referendum over the weekend and said, yes, Mr. President, take care of this crime problem. What are you going to be looking for in the coming weeks and months to see if Noboa is able to convert that political capital?
Well, they've already captured this morning a major target, a criminal key asset.
Yeah, we're seeing that news, reports of Fabricio Colon Pico, the leader of a gang called Los Lobos. He'd been on the run since escaping from jail on the 8th of January.
So I'll expect for President Noboa to capture many key targets that he himself has named. He has a list, but we still have to see if he can deliver. At the end of the day, he will be dealing with the same institutions and the same resources he had before. Except for a few legal changes, the problem with crime in Ecuador goes beyond what can be controlled by just the application of brute force by police and military forces. It goes beyond that.
Sebastian Hurtado heads Profitas, a political risk consultancy in Quito, Ecuador. He's been speaking with us about the government's efforts to combat drug gang violence there. 22,000 applicants for just 5 slots. That's how competitive it was to join the new astronaut class for the European Space Agency. And today at a ceremony in Cologne, Germany, the ESA welcomed the new cohort to its astronaut corps, bringing the total number of European astronauts to 11.
The prospective astronauts entered the training program already boasting impressive resumes, and then they endured a year of rigorous training. Some of it was physical. They spun in centrifuges, camped in snow, and were deprived of oxygen, temporarily, but still.
The academic training was just as tough. Physiology, anatomy, astronomy, meteorology, robotics, Russian language. That last part of the program, studying Russian, is significant. Russian is still one of the working languages spoken at the International Space Station.
This is just the 4th astronaut class to enter the European Space Agency since 1978. And that's the show for today. The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org and wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Please join us right back here tomorrow.
Supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the philanthropic foundation Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the advancement of international peace and security at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org. By the United States Japan Foundation, and by the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Amy Rao and Harry Plant, Roman Mars, and the Kelsen Foundation. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
KCYX's community calendar for the 22nd through the 28th comes from Word of Mouth Magazine, connecting visitors and locals alike to the food culture of Mendocino County. More at wordofmouthmendo.com. The Mendocino Women's Choir Spring Concerts are on Friday, 7:30 p.m., and Saturday at 2 and 7:30 p.m. in Preston Hall, Mendocino. Everyone's invited to the Logap Park Wildflower Walk on Saturday, 10 a.m. at the picnic tables near the tennis court. The Anderson Valley Wildflower Show is both Saturday and Sunday, 10 to 4, at the Mendocino County Fairgrounds. Aspire, delivering a message of hope and empowerment, shows on Saturday at both 2 and 7:30 p.m. at the Space Theater in Ukiah. Willits Center for the Arts Zine Fest is on Saturday, 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. with art opportunities for all. Also on display is Art Under 20. Alex DeGrassi and Friends perform a benefit concert for the Mendocino College Music Program on Saturday, 7 p.m. in the Little Theater. Walala Arts Center presents Bay Area jazz legends Dick Conte and Randy Vincent on Sunday, 4 p.m. The Ukiah Haiku Festival is on Sunday at the Civic Center from 2 to 4 p.m. And the Day of the Child celebration is at Alex Thomas Plaza, with lots of activities on Sunday between 2 and 7 p.m. Please let us know about your event or public service announcement at least 2 weeks in advance by submitting it to our calendar at kzyx.org.
You're tuned to KZYX Philo, 90.7 FM, KZYZ Willis in Ukiah, 91.5 FM, and in Fort Bragg, 88.1 FM. That's Mendocino County Public Broadcasting, listener-supported community radio. And with that, welcome to the discussion program for Earth Day 2024. This is your normal host for Fourth Mondays, Steve Scalmanini. And we have an hour together to discuss or for you to comment on anything you wish. This is the one-hour program every Monday evening, 7 to 8, during which you may call in here to 895-2448 and have your say. And maybe even put a few of you on together to see what you'd like to discuss over the phone. We can try that out.